You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 30th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, award-winning columnist for The Nation magazine and author Katha Pollitt on why gay marriage wins and why choice for women is losing. Also on the program today, protests turn a little bit, I don't know if violence is the right word. The cops, I should say, turned a little bit violent last night in protests in New York. Meanwhile, in Baltimore, gang members ensure the peace. It's Thursday, folks, and Bernie Sanders is going to announce his candidacy. Also on the program today, new report that the American Psychological Association worked hand in hand with the Bush administration to whitewash torture. And Chris Christie, you recall him, don't you? He used to be someone that people would talk about as a presidential contender. I'm really getting the feeling that money he's been raising is going to go towards his defense fund. Because David Wildstein, his best friend from high school who he doesn't remember, who he hired for the Christie administration, is about to plead guilty as early as tomorrow. And I imagine he's cut a deal. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. But before we get to any of that, this story I enjoyed quite a bit. As you know, the governor of our great state of New York is a huge a-hole. And I'm not just saying that because of his policies. Reportedly, he's just personally an odious person. But this really, this is a good sign that indicates to me at least he understands that his political career is more or less, this is it. Governor of New York, then it's on to Wall Street for him or wherever he'll go. Apparently, the Cuomo administration has quietly changed state regulations to reclassify, quote, any motor vehicle owned or operated by the governor and a handful of other top officials as emergency vehicles, allowing them to have flashing red and white emergency lights. Now, understand that Governor Cuomo already travels to official events in a state-owned SUV, like a big black SUV that has these lights. It's not like he's ever in a place where that vehicle's not around. He probably has multiple ones. and is always escorted or accompanied, I should say, by a state police detail. That's appropriate. But apparently now he wants to put flashing red and white emergency lights on his 1975 Corvette Stingray. Unbelievable. There you go. So that, you know what? And I am perfectly willing, if he promises never to run for office again, to give him a couple of years of being able to drive his Stingray around with a siren. For me, that's a great trait. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Katha Pollitt. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back. I don't think it's been years, but it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Katha Pollitt. She is the award-winning columnist for The Nation magazine. The column is subject to debate, and author, her most recent work is Pro Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Katha Pollitt, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, sorry. There we go. Yep, there you are.
Okay.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Sam.
So, this piece, I really enjoyed this piece, and it's sort of a perennial question as to why gay marriage is winning and other sort of, I guess, left and progressive agendas are losing. Your piece in The Nation from, I guess it was last week now, there's a reason gay marriage is winning while abortion rights are losing. Let's dig into that. You note that in Indiana, the attempt to enshrine opposition to gay marriage and it's sort of the promulgation of this one of these religious freedom bills was met with an incredible backlash, and not just an incredible backlash in a vacuum, but also in the context of where gay rights were just like 15 years ago. It's pretty stunning. Talk about that change so that people get a sense of that, of just how sort of stunning that backlash really was.
Oh, it's in Indiana, there was a huge backlash against the new Restoration of Religious Freedom Act, or whatever it's called, the RFRA, as they shorten it, that would allow people for religious reasons to discriminate in various ways against gay people. It's not just about gay marriage, but it was, the cases that came forward were things like, I'm a Christian baker, I don't want to make a cake for your wedding. Now the government is going to force me to make a cake for your wedding, and that violates my religious conscience. There was a huge backlash against those arguments. You had a lot of, quite a few major corporations threatening not to do business in the state. You had one religious denomination threatening to move its convention. It was quite, and all over the country, there was a huge uproar from, regular people. It had very little support except in the Christian right itself.
And so let's contrast that to what seems to happen. I mean, on a fairly regular drumbeat, particularly since I think 2010, in particular, in the States, in terms of rolling back a woman's rights to choose. Because I think, you know, periodically I've done shows where we've had reporters on who have documented this, and it really is sort of a stunning list that we don't hear much about.
It's so true, Sam, and this is what's quite surprising, that all over the, not all over the country, but in the red states and in some other states as well, some purplish states, clinics are being forced to close by laws that make it impossible for them to operate. Women are being subject to all kinds of restrictions, have to jump through all kinds of hoops, to the extent where, just to give you one example, in Missouri, there is now one clinic. You know, and Missouri is not North Dakota, a very low population state. Missouri is big. And if you want an abortion now in Missouri, you have to go to St. Louis. You have to wait 72 hours. So that means you might be driving across state, staying in this town, this city, for 3 days, which means you have to get a hotel. You have to take time off work. You have to put your children in some sort of child care for them. It raises the cost of an abortion enormously, and it places it out of reach for a lot of people. Now, do you have major corporations saying, well, we're leaving Missouri, this shows such disrespect to our female employees? No. You don't have people boycotting travel to Missouri or canceling their conventions. It's completely different. It's sort of, oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh, right. Well, that's not good. The end, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, and I want to go through, I mean, that dynamic in and of itself is sort of fascinating to me, and I want to go through the distinctions that you make between these two issues that explains part of, or at least is part of your theory as to what explains the difference in reactions. I mean, it was interesting. Yesterday we had on the program, we had Michelangelo Signorelli on the program talking about his book entitled It's Not Over, making the argument that now is no time in terms of the marriage equality fight and sort of the broader gay rights fight to rest or to not press forward. And one of the things he cited in our conversation was, you know, look at what's happened to a woman's right to choose. And because it was almost as if there's this sense of like, well, women have the right to choose, end of story. We don't really have to worry about it. And there's no awareness of how this right is being attacked on a daily, but on a weekly, monthly basis.
It's so true. And not only that, I think that abortion is a stigmatized choice. And that, I think, plays a part in it, too, that people think, yeah, I don't, you know, there are a lot of people, I talk about this in Pro, my book, that, you know, there are a lot of people, they don't want to see abortion banned, which is what the anti-abortion movement wants. They don't talk about that so much, but that's their end game, is no legal abortion. And people don't support that. The vast majority of Americans support Roe v. Wade. They want abortion to be more or less legal, but they don't feel good about it. And so each of these restrictions can be presented as something that, oh, well, now the whole thing is, oh, it's good for women, you know? We need to make clinics be like little hospitals. We need to have the doctor have admitting privileges at a hospital, even though the hospital won't give admitting privileges, because that's what keeps women safe. Well, you know, this is nonsense, but it lets people sort of think, yeah, abortion is kind of creepy. We want women to be safe. We, you know, maybe they should be forced to wait and see an ultrasound and get some, you know, biased state legislature written, quote, counseling, unquote, from a doctor, you know, stuff like that.
Are those two different things? I mean, because I think, like, to a certain extent, when you talk about the argument where you say that, you know, and this is one of the first distinctions that you write in your piece, that marriage equality is about love, romance, commitment, settling down, starting a family. Reproductive rights, by contrast, is about sex. sexual freedom, sort of the opposite of marriage. And it's interesting because when I contemplate an opponent to marriage equality, they are vehemently opposed to it. When I think about someone who is supportive, the idea of like someone saying like, I think there should be a right for marriage equality, but I think that I don't want to see too much of it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Nobody says, yeah, I'm okay with gay people getting married, but I just don't want to. I just think that we need to minimize it. Like that equation, right? Like,
right. No, it doesn't work. And I think, you know, they're constructed a little differently. We generally think marriage is great, you know? Yes. And marriage is also a socially conservatizing force. And I think that's one reason people like it, that the old image of gays, think back to before marriage equality was a thing, before it was even called marriage equality, back when it used to be gay marriage, you know, the image of gays was terrible. It was that they were promiscuous, they were child molesters, lesbians were lonely gym teachers, these people were a threat to normal life. And that has changed completely.
And marriage is almost like you could perceive it. I mean, if you start off with that image of who gays and lesbians are, this is almost like reparative.
Right. So this is like gays and lesbians are now your neighbors who buy Pottery Barn furniture and adopt children and are inviting you over to barbecue. It's completely different. Nobody talks about going to bathhouses anymore and stuff like that. That used to be the thing. I think marriage, you know, people can see it as a taming force.
Right.
And also marriage is completely optional now. I mean, it's from the point of view of marriage, the institution is really lucky that gays and lesbians are getting married because so many other people are not. Reproductive rights is constructed completely differently. For one thing, it allows sex without punishment. We don't like that idea. You know, when people say, you know, don't use abortion as birth control, you should be responsible. That's what they're talking about. They're saying, you know, all that sex is really a bad idea.
Right.
And the idea that women should pay for pleasure is very, very deep in our culture. The whole, you know, the whole use of the word slut all the time, it shows you that.
Well,
there is no such thing as a male slut.
And it's not just a question of perception, right? I mean, when you exercise your choice to have an abortion, it is an act that is sort of like you're fixing something on some level, right? I mean, it's like I'm going back to a state where it's a reaction. Right. An abortion obviously is a reaction as opposed to, you know, I have to get married because it's, you know, if marriage was just about, let's say, getting citizenship, then it would be perceived differently. I mean, I agree that the real animus towards abortion is a function of like we can't have women having sex and then just being able to not have to face the consequence of it. I definitely think that is, and we can see that within the context of contraception. But there is a sort of like, there is something different. It's not, the quality of it is different in terms of an abortion is a response to something as opposed to marriage is, I guess it's a response to being in love, but it's just a different, I think, sort of like a dynamic.
It is a little bit of a different dynamic, but what my piece was trying to do is saying we always talk about abortion and marriage equality as, you know, as aspects of the culture war. They're cultural issues. I hate this. And then once we put them together under that same umbrella, we become puzzled as to why abortion rights are, you know, in such trouble, and equal marriage equality is going forward. And my point is really, well, these are different issues, and they're different in a number of ways, and so we shouldn't be so surprised
right.
That they're not marching in lockstep.
Let's talk about the other points you bring up, where you say that same-sex marriage is something that men want.
Well, I think that's really, I think that that's very true, that if it were just, and I have to say, I'm totally in support of marriage equality. I think it's a civil right. It's we need to have it. But, you know, there's just no question in my mind, at least, that if only lesbians wanted to get married, we wouldn't be here. It would just be, oh, yeah, these strange women over there, they want to get married. It would not be a national issue. But even the vernacular gay marriage types it as a male concern. That's how it is in the mind of people, even though actually lesbians are more likely to marry than gay men, and a lot of important lawyers and people in the equal marriage movement are lesbians. But gay men have a certain amount of social and economic power. I've been reminded that gay men make less than straight men, and okay, but that's averaged out. There are now a lot of powerful gay men in the world.
I got to tell you,
they have used it to mainstream this cause. More power to them.
I got to tell you, I think from my perspective, and I want to go through the rest of these differences, but that to me is the fundamental one. Is that it centers around money. And let's circle back to that, because I'll just put like a flag there, because at the end of the day, I mean, this is a question about the success of activists to really obviously it's a long time coming, but in terms of where we were in 2004, let's say, versus today, it is a stunning reversal, at least from a sort of a statutory standpoint. I want to come back to that, because I want to talk about these other aspects that you mentioned. Marriage equality has a cross-class appeal. What do you mean by that?
Well, anybody can have a gay child, an LGBT child. And I think parents want, across the political spectrum, want their kids to have the same opportunities as their children. Look at the Cheneys. You know, you can't get more right-wing than that. And they supported their lesbian daughter. Their other daughter didn't support her, but, you know, the parents did. And that's very significant, I think. There have been a number of prominent Republicans who have discovered that their child was gay or someone else in their family was gay. And that's really opened up their eyes pretty quickly. Now, what's interesting is any woman might find herself needing an abortion, too. But she may not realize that. I think a lot of women think, and a lot of men involved with women, think, oh, well, that's never going to happen to us. You know, we're using birth control, and we're special, wonderful people. And abortions are just for sluts and poor people. They don't understand how common abortion is, 1 in 3 women.
But isn't it also, too, that if I'm wealthy, it really doesn't matter? In terms of things like curtailing access to abortion, because I've got money. It seems to me that there's never been but for the most part, when we talk about abortion being legal and found to be a right, that opened up abortion to people who were not wealthy, right? I mean, that it was always available if you had the money.
Well, first of all, it was always available, but it might not be safe. Illegal, generally, you don't want to have illegal medical procedures performed
right, right.
on you. There were a lot of middle class and even upper class women who had got into real physical trouble over illegal abortions, which could also be very degrading and hugely expensive and all the rest of it. So, you know, I think people say what you've just said. It's a very common idea. But, you know, what if you're a working woman? I mean, it's not just that, like, you're really low income or you're really rich. There are a lot of people still in the middle. Those women may not believe that it's going to be hard for them to find an abortion, but they're going to have a big surprise, because there you are in, let's say, Missouri at one end of the state, and you've got a job, you've got kids, maybe your husband isn't so keen on what you're doing, and all of a sudden, your privacy is gone, because arranging a 3-day trip is not very easy to do when you're a married person without them wondering what you're up to. You've got to, you know, it raises the cost tremendously. It makes it more difficult, more stressful, more awful. And I just think that people don't really understand what it's going to be like. But there's another thing too, Sam, which is that all this is happening in a very kind of geographically distinct kind of way. So that what you find is the states where the most pro-choice women live, like New York or California, big cities, that's where you can most easily get an abortion.
Right.
You know, so that these red states where the big problems are, you know, they're far from media markets. I mean, when was the last time you read a story about South Dakota?
Well, I mean,
you know, in every way.
Yesterday,
you think,
in my instance. Yeah. But yes, in the main, yes, I agree.
In the main, you know, or Wyoming, which doesn't have any clinics.
Right.
These are out-of-the-way places that are red states. And so it's a little harder for people living in New York to realize what's going on. After all, I mean, we are one country in the end, and things that start in those places don't stay there.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, I think a huge percentage of this show is about talking about some insane right-winger in South Dakota introducing something to the legislature, and then 3 years later we see that it's being adopted in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's...
Yes. Ohio is now a very big anti-choice state. And Ohio is, you know, it's not some obscure little corner of the country. Pennsylvania...
Let's talk about your last point. In marriage mm-hmm. equality, there is no loser. But you say, but including some who call themselves pro-choice, feel that the abortion creates a loser, the embryo or the fetus. Expand on that, because my perception is that explicitly for those who are against marriage equality, and it is a tough argument to buy for, you know, for rational people, but you're harming marriage if you open it up to just about anybody.
I know, but that is what they say. But they have never been able to make that very persuasive to anyone who didn't belong to specific religious denominations and the specific conservative ends of those denominations. You just can't explain how your gay marriage hurts my straight marriage. If they could do that, they might have a better shot at winning in the Supreme Court. But the thing about reproductive rights is there are two things. One is, unlike gay marriage, which costs society nothing and takes no power away from anyone, reproductive rights do come with a price tag. This is health care, and that means government funding is inevitably involved. And that means people get to say things like this one New Hampshire lawmaker I quote, "If you want to have a party, but don't ask me to pay for it." And that was about contraception.
Isn't that guy, yeah. I mean, I don't know if that guy in particular, but when people say that, aren't they really just saying, like, I'm going to cynically pretend this is actually about cost when in fact, you know, we spend more on, I don't know, the urinal cakes than we spend on that stuff practically.
Well, you could well be right. I don't want to speculate about people's motives, but it certainly sounds like that guy is not a fan of women having sex.
Right.
But the point is, because birth control and abortion do place demands on the state and on the taxpayer, that allows a way for people who are opposed to those things to make it harder for them to get. And that doesn't work with gay marriage. Gay marriage doesn't cost anybody anything. And so those whole things, what Hobby Lobby was about, was, does this employer have to pay, you know, have to provide contraception, certain forms of contraception that he believes are abortifacients, on his employees' health insurance? And the Supreme Court said, you don't have to do that. That's an invasion of your rights. Now, he couldn't make that point about his employees having same-sex marriages, you know. They're not asking him for anything. So it's different in that way. But I want to get to your other point, which is that there's no loser in gay marriage, but in abortion rights, not contraception, but abortion rights, there, even for some pro-choice people, they do feel, well, yeah, there's another interest in here, that of the embryo or the fetus. And what I say is you have to value women a lot to side with the pregnant woman, with all her inevitable, complicated story, her complexities, her flaws, over the future baby, which is pure potentiality. It has no character or personality or motives. There's nothing you can judge there. Whereas we love to judge women.
Yeah, I mean, let's expand upon that a little bit, because that's sort of, we're getting into the theme of your book, and I want to touch on that, because this is, you know, the I am of that mind that this is that it is problematic in terms of the struggle to maintain women's rights in terms of sovereignty over their own body. It's problematic to concede that abortion is this sort of like thing that should be legal, but is necessarily icky. I mean, it is, I think for me, going to the dentist is also pretty icky. And I'm not, it's slightly more invasive, I think, to get an abortion, but, I think it has to be seen in the context of a medical procedure, but one that also is incredibly, that allows women to have power in our society that they have been denied for, a long time.
Yes, that's all true. Now, you know, people have a lot of ideas about abortion, like when you say icky, for example, that don't really hold up. For example, I think partly because of the brilliance of the anti-choice messaging with, remember, partial birth abortion, where it really did look like, you know, a one-year-old, you know, that people think of abortion now as a late procedure, but it isn't. Most abortions, 80%, take place in the first trimester. They take place when, you know, it doesn't look like a baby. A lot of abortion now, and more would happen this way if it weren't for laws preventing it, are medication abortions where you take a pill in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy, 8 or 9 weeks of pregnancy. You know, is that icky? I don't know. I don't think I would say it was. You know, I think if we kind of if we sort of looked more at what abortion really concretely involves, when it happens and why it happens, we might feel differently about it.
But when you make that argument too, though, aren't you opening the door to people to focus on the other 20%? Right. It seems to me to be like sort of their strategy. I mean, I hate to keep going back to that, but when we were talking to Signorelli yesterday, he said that the next sort of front in terms of marriage equality, the right wingers are already equating to late term abortion, that they want to sort of like begin to chip away at stuff.
Anti-marriage people are talking about late-term abortion?
They are. They're coming up. They want to come up with their version of...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, I think they might have a hard time doing that, because either you're married or you're not married, right? I think that it's true that about 20% of abortions take place after the first... It's actually less than that. After the first trimester, but very, very few, like less than 1%, take place after 24 weeks. And then, you know, the state is allowed to say, you know, that you can't have a third trimester abortion except to protect the woman's health and life. So, you know, this picture people have of women just showing up, you know, a day before birth and saying, oh, I've changed my mind. This is completely ridiculous. There are actually three clinics in the whole country where you could get a third trimester abortion. And you have to go to this place. Those are the places in profiled in that very interesting documentary, After Tiller. It's really a big deal to get a very, you know, a very late abortion. And usually there's some problem with the mother or with the fetus. It's not just something people suddenly wake up and decide to do.
So let me just turn back to my theory on the difference and get your take on this, because I mean, I think to a certain extent you touch on it when it's something that, that men want. But it occurs to me that the real dynamic here, and this is sort of like where I've landed on why a marriage equality has been so much more successful than, say, like, I don't know, expansion of Social Security, just for instance, which has huge poll numbers, right? That fundamentally, when we talk about marriage equality, we have a tremendous amount of money out there. And it may be the case that the average gay man makes less than the average heterosexual man, but there are big millionaires, multimillionaires, perhaps billionaires, who are gay, who have lined up and basically put the money down on the table. And in contrast, I mean, you touched on this, that you have women's rights to choose being chipped away outside of places like New York and California, where to the extent that there's big money from women to fight against that, it is, you know, it's much harder to motivate someone. Like, you've got to make sure that people in Missouri have access to this, whereas on a daily basis in New York, you realize there's plenty of access. I mean, it seems to me that at the end of the day, it's really about money, which, you know, then maybe sort of subsidiary to that is who makes money in our society.
Well, I think money plays a role in everything. I think that's really true. I mean, you mentioned, for example, expanding Social Security. Which would cost money, but people, you know, a lot of people support it, but it would be a big burden on the state, right? And, so there are people that are very strongly against that. The people who think, yeah, government should be small, we don't want all these freeloaders, all the rest. Once money comes into, to politics, I think a lot of things change. And one thing we haven't talked about, though, is stigma. Now, to be gay is still in many places very stigmatizing, but that's really on the way down. You have a lot of people, a lot of celebrities, for example, coming out as gay, or even now coming out as trans with Bruce Jenner. But you don't have so many celebrities coming out and saying, yeah, I had an abortion, or, I mean, you have a few, I paid for my girlfriend's abortion. No, it's just a more stigmatized thing.
But there's also a sense, it also seems to me to be a lack of urgency that is driving that. In other words, you know, in terms of when I've spoken to people about that, that dynamic of people coming out and announcing that they're gay or coming out and saying that they're transgender, it is part of it is driven by the fact that, like, look, you know, you have some kid in Mississippi who is, you know, contemplating suicide. And
yeah,
because they don't have a sense that they have a sense that there's something fundamentally wrong with them. And it's incumbent upon people who, you know, who are gay or are trans to come out and say it's okay to be this way.
Yeah.
And that's going to have an impact. That dynamic does not seem to be in place, or at least there isn't that level of urgency.
Well, this is one reason I wrote my book. You know, you're really zeroing in, because I think that the shame that women feel about abortion, that they are made to feel by society and by their parents and by, you know, by their friends sometimes, and certainly by, you know, many organized religions, I think that this is a very important piece of the problem, that if you can't acknowledge, oh, yeah, I did that, and it was the right decision, and my life is better now, if you can't say that, then you are politically silenced. You can't get together with other people in the same situation who might be your friends, you know. You don't know whether your friends have had abortions or not a lot of the time, because they're not telling you. And so everybody then feels like, oh, let's just stay away from that. Let's just stay away from that issue. And that's why, with some, sorry, go on.
No, well, I was going to say that context when you're talking about friends is really where the delineation is, because I can understand why an actress doesn't, you know, here's my interview with E, and I'm not going to say, oh, incidentally, I had an abortion. There's nothing sort of compelling that. But in the context of when you're talking to your friends, you don't necessarily need the same things to compel you to tell you things to your friends. You tell them because you're your friends. It's something you experienced. You know, I tell my friends when I go, get a colonoscopy. Maybe I tell too many people. But the point being that the dynamic on there's that much more sort of weighing against you telling people, even in the context of a private conversation when it's theoretically not political.
Right. And, you know, there is another distinction, too, which is being, which you kind of got to a little bit, which is being gay is something that you are. You're gay every day. You know, you're a lesbian every day. But an abortion is a one-time experience in your life, and you can put it behind you. It doesn't define you, unless you tell the wrong person, you know?
Right.
So you can see why women would just want to just be quiet about it. But what I'm saying is that being quiet, that fear, allows stigma to flourish. A lot of people, and there's sociologist Sarah Cowan who studied this, a lot of people think they don't know anyone who's had an abortion. But they're probably wrong. They probably do know people who've had an abortion, but that person isn't telling them, because people are very careful who they tell. And they're not going to tell someone that they think is going to judge them. But what that means is that people who oppose abortion have a false idea of who has them. You know, they think, oh, that doesn't happen in my community. That doesn't happen to good Christians. That doesn't happen to people like me. But they're probably wrong.
Right. And it also just the fact that people are not telling them almost sort of perpetuates that stigma on some level. And when
exactly.
There's a stigma there, you assume that there's something wrong with it, even if it's a necessary evil or something is the way that people. All right. Well, Kath, before we go, let me ask you this, because everything now we're now at that time of the of our lives where everything is seen through a prism of the election. And of course, we have a very viable chance at having our first woman president. Hillary Clinton, when I think of Hillary Clinton's evolution, one of the things that I think of is, I think it was around 2004, where she was sort of on team and very, I think, relatively vocal about this idea of abortions are icky, but necessary, but maybe we can sort of mitigate them in some way. Is that an accurate assessment?
I wouldn't say that she said icky. I actually think icky is a word that maybe men use about female biology that women don't use.
Well, I'm saying icky.
Female biology, but not
I'm saying icky, not.
No,
I'm
not
saying icky because I'm actually sort of parroting that.
What she said was, abortion is you know, we have to keep it legal, but we have to also acknowledge it's a tragic choice for many, many women. Well, it's a tragic choice for some women. I don't think it's a tragic choice for all that many women. I think studies have shown women are okay.
But what does that mean, even like a tragic choice?
Well, I think she meant that when she was talking. Well, I don't want to speak for her. I think what she meant may have been that there are women who would like to have a baby, but they can't have the baby because of circumstances beyond their control. And so they have an abortion. And I don't think we have any idea how many women would fit that bill. There are also a lot of women who want to have abortions and they can't get them. Especially, you know, because of all these restrictions, because it isn't covered by Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera. But And she did say back then, you know, we have to push adoption. That's going to make a difference. Adoption is never going to make a difference in the number of people who have abortions, because adoption is not a choice that very many women want to make. It's tiny, actually. So anyway, I'm glad that she's moving away from that way of talking about abortion, because I think that way of talking about abortion was not helpful. I think it was stigmatizing.
Yeah, I mean, I just say that it's tragic. It seems to me that that is a very problematic way. I mean, that runs like counter to, I think, like, I mean, to your whole argument on some level, too.
Well,
I mean,
it can be tragic if you want to have a baby. Let's say you want to have a baby and you're going along in your pregnancy, and then it turns out there's some, you know, your baby doesn't have a brain. Your baby is anencephalic. And rather than go through the pregnancy and watch your baby die, you decide to have a termination. But that's very painful. That is tragic.
Oh, I have no doubt that there are tragic scenarios around that. Like, I mean, I can imagine it's a tragic scenario that you and your husband decide that now's not that time to have a child. We can do it. We'll do it. We'll have a child later. And then your husband gets on an airplane and crashes, and that's tragic too. I'm saying, though, when you go out there and you say that that's a tragic choice for women, I can come up with a scenario on any choice that anybody could make that is in some instances tragic, but then it is not a tragic choice. It is a simply
choice. I agree with you.
Right.
I agree with you completely. I think that I criticized her for saying that at the time. And I think that those were, that was a sort of weaselly way to talk about abortion. And I don't think it helped, keep abortion available. But you know, the whole thing, the Clintons had that phrase, remember, safe, legal, and rare.
Right.
And I didn't like that either, because the point isn't whether abortion is rare or common. The point is it accessible? We might find that if every woman who wanted an abortion could get one without a whole, you know, jumping through all those hoops, there was more abortion.
Right.
And then you would want to say, well, gee, we really need to do something about that birth control situation here, you know, and the element of sexual ignorance and coercion and manipulation and everything that goes on. But we wouldn't say, oh, this number is the problem number.
Right.
It's not about numbers. It's about freedom and access and being able to make a good decision for yourself.
Well, Kath Apollett, the piece is there's a reason gay marriage is winning while abortion rights are losing. And, of course, we will put a link to your most recent book, and we'll put a link to all your books.
Thank you.
And your column at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Bye-bye.
It was fun. Bye.
There's that noise. Figured out how to custom that noise, but we just don't know what it's going to be. I mean, I think Hillary is off that that thing, but that one thing really stuck in my craw back in 2004. That notion of that decision being tragic. There's no doubt in my mind that for some people, that decision is tragic. But also, there's tragic decisions in putting off. I don't know, going into have a tooth removed. I'm sure in some instances someone dies because of the tooth, and that's a tragic decision. I just think that to characterize that decision, that choice, in a general way as tragic is wrong. It's wrong. And frankly, and I would believe that there is a significant percentage of people who are listening to me right now who have either chosen themselves to get an abortion or whose loved one has chosen to get abortion and don't perceive it as tragic. It was a decision they made. They got the abortion. They went on with their lives. That's it. But for the fact that it's stigmatized by society, they wouldn't think about it anymore. And even to the extent that it's stigmatized about the society, they don't think about it. I don't know. That obviously gets my goat, as it were. But I think Hillary has moved on. And we're going to talk about Hillary moving on in the funner half of the program. We're going to talk about Bernie Sanders. I'm genuinely excited. Matt Taibbi had wrote a great piece about Bernie Sanders, and I'm genuinely excited. I am more excited than I anticipated I would be about his declaration. I mean, I assumed he was going to run and this and that, but I am genuinely more excited about it. I don't know that he's going to win. I don't know that anybody else is going to win, for that matter. But I'm certainly very interested in hearing him and seeing him on stage during a debate. And just the idea of him having that platform to reach the American public. Because the beauty is, when he debates Hillary Clinton, there's going to be a whole set of people, because you know that those right-wingers are going to be watching those debates with a passion that they've rarely watched Democratic debates before, right? I mean, even like, there's going to be a lot of people in there who are going to, like, I want to, you know, just because of their hatred of Hillary, are going to watch these debates. And then they're going to be exposed to something that they've never heard before. They're going to be exposed to ideas that they've never heard before that cannot be marginalized. Because Bernie Sanders is just not, you know, short of his like Queens accent, it's Brooklyn Queens accent. He's just the guy. You know, there's no, he's a bright guy and he doesn't, you know, I mean, there were some things about Dennis Kucinich, some of his ideas I appreciated. Others not so much, but this is a guy who's pragmatic enough to get elected to the Senate, but with policy prescriptions that I think are going to, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens when people are exposed to that in the way that they're going to be exposed. I'm very excited about it. I will take a quick break. Head into the fun half of the program. Ladies and gentlemen, we now have, 24 hours left on the, is it less? 16 hours left on the Indiegogo campaign. I cannot tell you how excited I am, both in terms of the participation. 493 people have given to this campaign, which is a lot. It's a lot of people. We have surpassed our goal. Obviously, we have plenty of stuff to spend our money on in this campaign. We still have some perks left. We've got T-shirts. We've got Don Quixote. We'll make a great caricature of you. You can use it as your Twitter avatar, your Facebook avatar, your future social media avatar. You can give it as a gift to your family, your friends, and also the shopping bags, Jewelry Report shopping bags. You go to the shopping and the Marin Cedar hours, all of it. It's all there. You got 15 hours if you want to go. And do it. And I'm so excited for this to end because I don't like doing it. I don't know that there was one part of that process that I enjoyed. So I'm very happy it's ending. I much prefer to ask people to become a member of the show, but we needed that one-time capital investment to just sort of bulk up, to just sort of like skip the incremental growth so that we could bulk up and do something that hopefully will grow the revenue of the show so that it's sort of can support what this one-time capital investment will do. So you can become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com and just click on the link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap through there. Also, justcoffee.coop. This is the last day, ladies and gentlemen. You get free shipping. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off on top of the free shipping. Oh, don't make a mistake and let this opportunity pass you by. Also, give us a review on iTunes. The reviews have been fantastic. Very much appreciated. Give us a review on Stitcher if you listen to the show on Stitcher. That's helpful. All of it's helpful. See what's happening here? They're doing like a marketing push. I don't know if I can sustain it, folks. I'm exhausted. So, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. You can IM me through the Majority Report app, which I hope you all got after my telling you to get it yesterday. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.